We're going to pay tribute to Chuck Jones, the great animator and director who helped bring to life such cartoon superstars as Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Elmer Fudd, and Porky Pig. He directed them in some of their finest roles. Jones was the sole creator of Pepe Le Pew, Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote. Chuck Jones died on Friday of congestive heart failure. He was 89. He worked at Warner Brothers from 1933 until the studio closed its cartoon division in 1963. Then he formed his own production company and created primetime TV specials. Before we hear a 1989 interview with Jones, let's listen to an excerpt of a 1988 interview with animation expert Steve Schneider, author of That's All, Folks, The Art of Warner Brothers Animation. The cartoon excerpts you'll hear in this were directed by Chuck Jones. I asked Schneider about one of the characters Jones helped develop, Daffy Duck.
He began really as the flightiest and the kind of most footloose of them all, but gradually became more inwardly directed. He was a creature really responding to a kind of set of neuroses which was unused to being present in animated cartoons. I mean, he became self-serving and greedy and egotistical at the same time as he would always set himself up for failure. And again, as in, I think, the Roadrunner cartoons, which came later, it's a relationship between desire and failure that motivates so many of the Warner comic underdogs, like the Coyote and also Daffy Duck. For some reason, most of the directors, certainly all of the stronger directors, Tex Avery, Bob Clampett, Chuck Jones, a couple of the others, found in Daffy, I think, perhaps their most receptive vehicle. They would refashion him virtually from picture to picture. And he became perhaps the strongest statement of their individual temperaments as filmmakers.
Now, Daffy Duck in many cartoons was hunted by Elmer Fudd. That was also the fate of Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny was also hunted by Elmer Fudd. Elmer Fudd was not very bright, always getting conned by Bugs and Daffy. Let's hear a clip of Elmer Fudd's voice. And this is from a 1952 cartoon called Rabbit Seasoning.
It's wabbit season. Oh, boy, wabbit twax. Oh, White Wabbit, I know you're there. If you're not out in 10 seconds, I'll blast you out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, Wabbit, now I got you.
What's up, Doc?
I'm hunting wabbits. It's wabbit season.
I've always thought of Elmer Fudd as being the square in the cartoons. Also, the stupid authority figure. The authority figure who was always conned by the other characters.
Yeah, exactly. He's kind of the all-purpose dimwit aggressor. You know, some people have, over the years, kind of raised some hackles about the allegedly violent content of these cartoons. And let's face it, Fudd might be an example of this because he's always coming after someone with a rifle, or at least in his most prototypical occasions. And if you think about it, in every single one of Warner cartoons, the aggressor is always the one who loses. I mean, it has a kind of anti-violent attitude in a strange sense. If you get too heavy, firstly, you're made to look ridiculous because you're such a sap, in the case of Fudd, or so flustery and so blustery like Yosemite Sam. The morale here is that antagonism never pays off in these films. You always get your just desserts from someone who is sharper or wittier or more resourceful than you are.
Let's move on to the Warner Brothers superstar, and that's Bugs Bunny. They're a great song and dance man, and this is called What's Opera, Doc? And the plot, of course, is Elmer Fudd hunting Bugs Bunny, but it's all done in opera.
Oh, mighty warrior of great fighting stock, might I inquire to ask him, what's up, Doc?
I'm going to kill the wabbit.
Almighty hunter, 'twill be quite a task. How will you do it, might I inquire to ask?
I will do it with my spear and magic helmet.
Your spear and magic helmet?
Spear and magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Magic helmet.
Bugs Bunny was really the great vaudevillian, the great opera star, the great song and dance man of the Warner Brothers cartoons. How did he get that kind of entertainment, Mr. Entertainment personality?
Ha, Well, I just think that he was a creature of infinite flexibility and essentially...
He's talented.
Yeah, I mean, before long, he was all bunnies to all people. Before long, they just had him do everything, and there was always a new context for him.
It was funny, you know, I was watching a lot of the cartoons last night, and there were so many cartoons, including the one we just heard an excerpt of, in which Bugs Bunny disguises himself by appearing in drag and trying to do the sexual tease on whichever hunter is hunting him.
Yeah, almost from his very first film, that's a bit of the bunny shtick. Again, it's because, well, as I mentioned, it's almost like he has no weight of a self. He can do virtually anything. He's quicker than Groucho and tougher than Cagney at the same time. And I think going in drag was, you know, the cartoons were always sort of ghettoized or never really considered mainstream artworks in their own way. And this way, at the very, very margins of the movie world, these guys were able to get away with some subversive images or ideas that were just neglected. The only way that it was possible is that these things were so ignored for so long that they carved out a little niche of freedom for themselves.
Steve Schneider recorded in 1988 after the publication of his book, That's All, Folks. We're remembering the animator and director Chuck Jones, who helped bring to life Porky Pig, Elmer Fudd, Daffy Duck, and Bugs Bunny, and was the sole creator of Pepe Le Pew, Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote. He died Friday. I spoke with him in 1989, after the publication of his autobiography, Chuck Amuck. The title was borrowed from Duck Amuck, Chuck Jones' cartoon about cartooning. In it, Daffy Duck finds himself at the mercy of a fickle cartoonist. Daffy opens the cartoon as a brave musketeer, but the cartoonist keeps changing the scenery on him to the most inappropriate settings, a farm, the Arctic, Hawaii. The cartoonist eventually erases not only the background, but Daffy himself.
Would it be too much to ask if we could make up our minds? Dashing through the snow, through the fields we go, laughing all the way. Farewell to thee, farewell to thee. The wind will carry back our sad refrain. One last embrace before we say, Buster, it may come as a complete surprise to you to find that this is an animated cartoon. And that in animated cartoons, they have scenery. And in all the years I... All right, wise guy, where am I?
Chuck Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. You changed a lot of the characters who you worked with over the years.
Uh-huh.
Can you describe, when you first started directing Daffy Duck, who was always my favorite, when you started directing Daffy Duck, what was he like? And then maybe you could tell us a little bit of the character changes that you brought to Daffy.
All the characters, I felt, were part of me, particularly Daffy and the Coyote, because they made the kind of mistakes that most of us make, only multiplied a bit. But Daffy was an interesting character, I think, because he would rush in and fear to tread at the same time. And he also could be fawning and overbearing at the same time. And I think that happens with very many of us when we, sometimes in the reverse, when we go in to talk to the boss and ask for a raise, we're overbearing. When we get inside, we're fawning. But Daffy is both at the same time. At the beginning, he was just crazy, as was Bugs, even in the first great, Wild Hare that Tex Avery directed. The character was really kind of mad, more like Harpo Marx, perhaps. And I was never comfortable with a character unless I could understand him, and I can't understand crazy people. So I always try to sort of pasteurize my characters to find out who they are. Who is the whole point about character animation is not what. It isn't what a character looks like or indeed how it's drawn.
You sound like a method animator.
Well, I guess so. I don't think that I could do it unless I cared about the characters.
In your cartoon, Duck Amuck, why did you choose Daffy Duck as the character that was going to be at the whim of the cartoonist?
Well, I tried it later with Bugs Bunny and didn't work. Fortunately, I did Duck Amuck first, then I did one called Rabbit Rampage. And he also had the same problem, and the person in this case turned out to be Elmer Fudd that was moving him around. But it didn't work because that's not the kind of a person that Bugs is. Bugs is a comic hero, you see, as compared with a comic wimp, which would go back to all the great comedians, starting with Chaplin and Buster Keaton and all the rest of them. They were they're all kind of semi-losers, aren't they? They're more like us. And but I always liked Daffy because he would continue beyond where I would stop simply because I'd be afraid of what the community would think of me. Daffy continues. So, but when I was working with him, all I had to do was reach down inside of me and bring the Daffy up to the surface and spread it out and take a look at it and see what would I do if I were if I had Daffy Duck's courage.
Mm-hmm. What about Bugs Bunny? What are some of the changes you brought to Bugs's life?
Well, I think that they, well, one of the nice things about there were three units there. After 1946, in fact, all the films that Warner now owns were directed by Fritz Freleng or Bob McKimson or me. Bob Clampett left in 46 and Tex around 44. So we had these wonderful sessions. When I would get an idea for a film, or my writer and I would get an idea for a film, we'd call in the other directors and writers, and we'd sit down and have this session, which we called a yes session, which meant for 2 hours nobody could say anything negative. If you couldn't contribute to the idea, your job was to shut up. The result of this was that we were all involved with each other's picture, although each director had absolute control of what went into his own pictures. But there was no internecine warfare. We liked each other. We wanted each other to succeed. But if I gave a great gag to Fritz Freleng and he used it, and it appeared on the screen and got an enormous laugh, naturally I wanted to go out and throw up. But I, because that's human nature, that's Daffy Duck in me.
All the great characters of the Warner Brothers cartoons are all animals. They're animals with the traits of people, but they're not people. They're ducks and rabbits and skunks. What are some of the advantages of using animals instead of people for the cartoons?
Well, we had ample precedents to go on. I mean, going back to Aesop's Fables and Kipling, and even Mark Twain did several things about animals, and of course Beatrix Potter and so many others. But the main thing is that it's easier to humanize animals than it is to humanize humans. And it's as you know from seeing Snow White and the Poor Princes and all the Disney films, it's very difficult to animate human beings. And when we did animate them, they didn't look very much like human beings. I mean, Elmer Fudd doesn't look any more like a human being than Bugs Bunny looks like a rabbit. Bugs is obviously not a rabbit. Rabbits look more like, and the average rabbit looks very much more like a pillow than anything else. However, I think that taking a rabbit and making him as heroic as Bugs Bunny is a lot more easy than it is to take a human being and make him like Bugs, with Bugs' characteristics.
You always believe that in a cartoon world that you have to create certain rules of the universe, and the characters always have to live within those rules. Give us an example through, say, the Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote cartoons, because you created those characters.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the universe that you created them in.
Well, there are several things that happen when in all comedy. The more you channelize, the more you narrow your character down, the better it gets. For some reason, take Charlie Chaplin, when he once got that little costume, look how much he was restricted in what he could do. He could only be the little tramp, but he could be the little tramp and he also limited the little tramp pretty much into living in a city. Well, we felt that when we got the Roadrunner and Coyote going, it was evident that they both lived in the southwestern American desert. And so you immediately say to yourself, that's where they live, that's where they got to live. And the fact that the Roadrunner is a Roadrunner means that he should stay on the road. And there were a number of other rules about that the Roadrunner can never harm the Coyote. The Coyote can only harm himself by buying those unfortunate things he gets from the Acme Corporation. So on. So that's what we... And the more rules you apply, you never hear any other sound except the beep-beep. And I found that going back then to Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny is such a powerful character that he could become a terrible bully. So we always started Bugs. In every picture, we started him in a natural rabbit environment, minding his own business, a quiet living rabbit, something like Rex Harrison, perhaps, before he got involved with My Fair Lady, ladies. And then someone comes along and tries to deprive him of his foot or his life or his, you know, or send him off on a rocket or something. And then he has to fight back, you see. And once engaged in the war, then he's happily engaged. But without that, he would just be a bully. And this is vital and necessary if you wanted the character to be believable and for people to care about him.
We're listening to a 1989 interview with animator and director Chuck Jones. He died Friday. We'll continue the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. The great Looney Tunes animator and director Chuck Jones died Friday at the age of 89. Let's get back to our 1989 interview with him.
One of the characters you created was Pepe Le Pew, this skunk who thinks he's very debonair and quite irresistible, but he's really quite repulsive. He has no idea. And he has this great fractured French that he speaks. As a matter of fact, let me just play a little excerpt of Pepe Le Pew, and this is from a cartoon that you won an Academy Award for, Sentimental Reasons.
Quelle est? Ah, the petite femme skunk. The rendezvous, no? Ah, my darling, how beautiful you are. How lonesome it has been that I have without you. The sweet nothings. The sweet somethings. The tender enrapturements. But I forget. But of course, the rendezvous.
Why did Pepe Le Pew have to be a French skunk?
Because it's funnier that way. A Bulgarian skunk probably wouldn't have been as interesting, or any Egyptian skunk. So, I don't know, French, that the idea that French believe that they are the most desirable of all men, I don't know, that's still prevalent, but at that time we thought of them that way. But I was a complete wimp in high school, and I was 6'1", weighed 132 pounds, so girls looked right through me. You could see other men. So I suppose it was natural for me to find to compensate for that by making a character who, regardless of what he was, believed he was an absolute, the most desirable of all people.
Now, I grew up on the Warner Brothers cartoons, and the older I'd get, the more jokes I'd get. But I never realized I was missing anything when I was young, you know, because I always liked them. And now as an adult, I see things that I didn't see when I thought I was getting all the jokes when I was an older kid. Did anyone at Warner Brothers ever give you an argument that certain things there would go over the head of the heads of the audience?
Yeah. Yes, they did. But we didn't pay attention to them. We always had going battles on with our producers, so they would issue edicts like, don't make any pictures about bullfights, bullfights aren't funny. Well, that immediately would say, well, gee, obviously the guy has always been wrong, so we made a picture about a bullfight and it turned out fine. No, we had very little problem. Fortunately, our producers were not very bright.
Well, who did you have to answer to?
Nobody. Because our pictures went out with the Warner Brothers features, and they were always played in theaters. And we really didn't know anything about how they were received until eventually we would get word from the exhibitor, who, after all, was the one who could judge his audience's response. So, no, we only made them for ourselves. We never made them for anybody else. We couldn't preview, and we weren't allowed to. There were no such things as these idiotic demographics and Nielsen ratings and stuff. And the first critic hadn't been born, so we just tried to amuse one another, and it seemed to work.
I remember once seeing a short film that was a combination of kind of pornographic cartoons that some of the Disney animators drew in their off hours.
Yeah.
And it ended up getting into circulation. Did you guys ever do anything like
that
at Warner Brothers? Yeah?
Yeah, everybody did that. In fact, sometimes when in a Pepe Le Pew picture, I would I'd put a little salacious one frame in 1/24th of a second, and I'd actually put it in the picture. And then I'd ask the office manager to come in. I said, "There's a little glitch here. There's starting to hop at this point. I don't know what it. I can't figure out what it is." And then I'd bring it to a stop in the moviola, and you know that thing when you look through, and there it'd be. You know, well, I knew nobody could ever see it because it was 1/24th of a second, but then he would go into shock. You know, and we always had a frame to replace it just in case. But I enjoyed doing that. It kind of put him in his place.
So did he make you take that out, or did those frames stay?
No. I told him it was too late. It would cost money to take it out, and nobody would ever see it. But I had already inserted it. It wasn't there anyway. But I did it to see if I couldn't put him into, as we used to say, reduce him to moccasins.
Chuck Jones recorded in 1989. He died Friday at the age of 89.